This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. A quick note before we get started. Today's conversation about political conventions first aired last night on Facebook Live through a collaboration with our colleagues here at Indiana Public Broadcasting. It's been lightly edited to fit our radio format. Indiana Democrats held their virtual convention on Saturday, and Republicans will hold theirs on Thursday of this week. So we wanted to have a conversation about what these conventions are, what role they play, what's happening this year, and how the pandemic has changed things. And it certainly has. And we're joined by these two guests. Laura Wilson is assistant professor of political science at the University of Indianapolis. Welcome to you, Laura.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Brandon Smith is our State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Brandon.
Thanks so much.
Laura, let's start with the most basic question possible. What is a party convention?
In the most basic answer possible, I like to think of it as a political pep rally. And even though that's an oversimplification, I think if you hear me out, you'll understand why I make that. It's a chance for everyone in the party to get together, especially the delegates. It's an opportunity to meet the candidates, who's going to be representing you. You get to hear, we talk about the platform, what it is you stand for. People get really excited. They're encouraged. And it is a political pep rally in that way, because people are starting to focus. You know, we've done the primaries. We've picked our candidates. There is some voting, of course. I'm sure we'll talk about that. But we're moving on to the general. Why are we want to get excited for our candidates? Why do we want people to vote for us? And kind of building that enthusiasm that I like to think transitions us from the primary election into the general for November.
So do you think that people like you and me generally pay attention enough to these and they know enough about them?
No, I don't think so. And part of it's probably because the conventions themselves aren't really targeted at maybe people like you and me. I mean, I'm interested in politics, certainly.
Yeah, maybe that was a bad example, because you would certainly be someone who might pay attention, and maybe I would too.
Pay attention. But I think, you know, the average person on the street, right, they probably aren't paying attention, and generally these wouldn't matter. We have some special things going on in Indiana right now, but usually this is really focused on your partisan, and especially your hyper-partisan. Certainly the delegates, people who are candidates, people who are working for campaigns. Those are the people that are getting really enthused about conventions and probably even know that we have state conventions. I think a lot of folks just focus on the RNC and the DNC, and they might not realize that we have these conventions at the state level as well.
And I mean, we're doing our best to help everybody understand right now, but what are some other ways that people can get informed on this? What's your advice, I guess, to people looking for a good civic education?
Yeah, well, there's a lot you can actually read about them. Both the Republican and the Democratic Party at the state level press, they put out their bylaws. They explain the delegate process. They explain the platform. So, you know, most people have a general sense probably of what Republicans and Democrats stand for. But if you want to see what the Indiana Democrats say they're standing for and what the Republican, Indiana Republicans say they're standing for, they put all that information out. Personally, for convention information, I would go right to the party source. And they're pretty open, I think, and they're pretty transparent in terms of what they stand for and what they're doing in the convention process.
Okay, so, but has the function of the conventions, the party conventions, changed at all over the years? Is it there for a different reason now than it maybe used to be?
Well, historically, if we're going way back, I mean, there was a point where conventions were what I always picture them to be, and they're not like this anymore, but I always picture, you know, these old white men with top hats and cigars in a smoky back room, and they're picking, okay, I'm going to have this candidate in District 1 and this candidate in District 2, and long time ago. We have primaries now. So those decisions aren't made by the party. Those are made by voters in the primary process. The parties still play a role in the convention, though, because they are helping. We have delegates. They're selecting things like Attorney General in Indiana right now. We can talk about that later. They're still talking about the platform, and they're still bringing together that cohesion, that enthusiasm, that excitement that's really important for the convention to carry on in the general election. This year in particular is different, obviously, because of COVID-19 and handling the conventions online in a virtual platform, which they've never done before. But that's a more recent change and something I'd say I don't know that we'll anticipate that staying in the future. Yeah, I wouldn't imagine it. Versus pre-primary, conventions used to be an entirely different ballgame than what we see today.
Mm. Brandon, I mean, she talked about the fact that that sometimes or oftentimes, I guess maybe they're a political pep rally. Did you happen to see any of the Democratic convention over the last weekend? And was it the pep rally that it would normally be, but now under this virtual?
Yeah, I did. I watched all of the Democratic convention because I'm a regular person. I watched all the CC in part because it was a little different. Obviously, in a normal year, I would be attending these conventions in person. Now, I want to differentiate a little between sort of the public side of the convention and the more private side of the convention, even for the media. And that goes to both a normal year and this year. So in a normal year, you have district meetings. So these are the delegates at the convention who are split up by congressional district across the state. They have more private meetings to make, in some cases, voting decisions, but in other cases, to talk about issues within their district, to sort of, as Dr. Wilson talked about, sort of gear up for November and the general election. The same sort of things happened this year where you had speakers, notable names, congressional candidates, the gubernatorial candidate, folks like that speaking to these district groups at their private virtual meetings. But then the public side of it, which was something that anybody could tune into this year, which is also a little different from your normal year because not anyone is allowed to go to the convention. But you had a notable congressional candidate. So in this case, Christina Hale, who's running in the 5th district, which will be probably the most, not probably, it will be the most competitive congressional campaign in Indiana this fall. You had the gubernatorial candidate, Woody Myers, the lieutenant governor candidate, Linda Lawson, both attorney general candidates, Karen Tallien and Jonathan Weinzappel. And I'll pause for a second and just say I was almost late tonight because Democrats just announced who won the attorney general nomination for their party for this fall, and it was former Evansville Mayor Jonathan Weinzappel. But they all gave speeches, Andre Carson, Pete Buttigieg, folks like that. They gave speeches to rally the troops and talk about the message. Joe Biden, they had a taped message from Joe Biden. They had a taped message from Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, which is also not unusual. Normally you have a sort of guest speaker, a notable Democrat from somewhere besides Indiana come in and talk to a convention, or at least their big fundraising dinner the night before. So in this case, it was Gretchen Whitmer, who's been, of course, in the national news quite a bit lately, as well as being a neighbor of Indiana's. So it didn't have the same feel, obviously, because you can't replicate virtually that sort of packed convention hall, everybody cheering atmosphere. But there were a lot of participants, and in that way, it helped that sort of organizational quality to these conventions as you as a party come together and say, okay, let's go.
But is there anything different about how they're being conducted for reasons other than the pandemic, or is that one of the only variables that makes this year so much different?
Yeah, it's all about the pandemic. It's just having to go to everything virtually. And then the way that changed, not only the way that they met, but also the way that they had to vote for the few things that they voted for.
So how is that voting process working this year?
Democrats were pretty happy. We don't know what the Republican process is going to, the outcome, because it hasn't started yet. So Democrats did their voting process even a little differently than the Republicans did, in the sense that both parties are doing vote by mail, principally. The Democrats did offer a couple of options for folks who maybe didn't get their mail-in ballots. They could vote by phone. They had to have a special delegate number that came with materials that the party had sent out. So that was sort of like a backup option. But the vast majority of it was conducted by mail, but mail-in ballot. But while this, the broadcast that Republicans are going to do tomorrow night on Wish TV and its affiliates across the state and streaming online will feature convention speeches and all four of their attorney general candidates addressing delegates. Democrats did something similar a couple of weeks ago, but unlike the Republicans, the Democrats, who had their two AG candidates speak, were doing so while ballots had been sent out 2 weeks prior. So voting had already happened, was already going on. The Republicans aren't going to send out their ballots until after this broadcast tomorrow night. So this will give these four candidates a chance to address every single one of those delegates before a single one of them has cast a vote. Now, the good bet is many of them have already decided how they're going to vote. But for sure, none of them have actually sent in a ballot yet or even gotten their ballot. So it was even a little different in how they did their vote by mail systems.
So does that say that, or rather, does that mean, I guess, that we won't get results as quickly after after theirs? Yeah.
Yeah. For example, the Democrats had their broadcast last Thursday. Their convention was last Saturday. But tonight we got the results of the AG nomination. Republicans, they will have their ballots due by July 9th. And I believe they expect to announce the winner of their AG candidacy on July 10th. So yes, like in the primary election we just saw, where results were in many cases very delayed for several days in some cases, a similar system is happening here where they will start voting one day and it'll take a couple weeks before we find out what the final results are.
Well, we'll definitely get into more on the Attorney General nomination. But Laura, let's go back to basics again. Who gets to go to conventions?
Yeah, well, as Brandon mentioned, the accessibility is really different this time around because there is that public atmosphere where you can actually log in and watch. And we've already had the Democratic one, but the Republican one is tomorrow. So you could very easily attend yourself, at least for those public portions of it. Traditionally, you're really focused on the delegates and the candidates. There is the press component, but you have to have a press pass. So it's usually a lot more restrained. And that's the one thing I could see maybe bleeding over into future years, if there was interest, if there's enthusiasm or appeal that people like the transparency of being able to access just a little bit of this and being able to log into it from home versus going downtown to the convention center. And I'm say downtown because I'm an Indianapolis resident. There's a whole different dynamic traditionally than what we have right now, but it's been made a lot more accessible because of this online platform, at least for those public parts, relative to what it usually is, which is really much more focused on the hyper-partisan aspect of the state parties.
How does somebody become a delegate? I feel like this conversation I feel like we have this conversation every 4 years, but I'm always curious.
Yeah, well, they can choose to run as a delegate, much like as a candidate, I suppose, although you talk about low information elections. It'd be really hard pressed to say who are the delegates and things like that. But individuals choose to run and then they're on the ballot as a delegate. They're either voted in or not. And then they represent. The state parties have different numbers in terms of how many delegates they have and things like that. But just like a candidate, they choose to run and they opt into the system.
After a quick break, we'll have more from our conversation on political conventions in Indiana. Since our show today was pre-taped, we can't get your questions and comments to our panel of guests like usual. But let us know what you think and what you want us to cover next. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our conversation on political conventions in Indiana, taken from a Facebook Live event we had last night through a collaboration with our colleagues here at Indiana Public Broadcasting. Let's look at the comparison between state conventions and national ones. How does a state convention like the one we had over the weekend for the Democrats and the one that's happening on Thursday for the Republicans, how does that compare to the big national ones?
Oh, man. The biggest thing would be the size, I think, no doubt, and certainly in terms of scope as well. Obviously, for the national conventions, you're talking about stretching it over days versus these, which are a matter of hours. The number of people you have talking, as Brandon said, you had Gretchen Whitmer. A lot of times you'll have, you know, like maybe one or two keynotes that aren't part of the state party, but you always expect to have your who's running for governor candidate, who's running for whatever it is. When we talk about like the DNC or the RNC, this is kind of a smattering, a highlight over days of people I think they see as front runners. So the next line, people who are the old line, people that they, we need to have someone from a southern state, or we need to have someone from this block, this ideology, whatever it might be. In terms of that smattering, I think the biggest thing is the scope, no doubt. But also the national conventions really seem to be focused singularly on the presidency. And that is their sole goal. They may highlight candidates. They have speakers that are running for office too. How great is that? But relative to the state party, where these state conventions are talking about governor, they're talking about attorney general, they're highlighting a lot of different things policy-wise. I think on the national level, it is that really singular focus of the presidency and looking at that in November.
So everything's so different this year with the pandemic, and that's pretty much the biggest variable, of course. But even under normal circumstances, is there a difference between, at the state level, the Democrat and Republican conventions, or are the procedures pretty much exactly the same at both?
This actually is probably a better question for Brandon. I know when I've read the bylaws, to me, they do have slightly different processes, as Brandon mentioned, in terms of the voting. I think it's fascinating to see the Republicans are waiting. You have to wait until you've heard people talk. Now, you may already know how you're going to vote, but you have to wait. Democrats, you could have already voted. You didn't even have to go to the convention and listen to them. So I would just say, from my perspective, when I've read the bylaws, there's small nuanced differences. I don't see a lot, but I'll toss it to Brandon and get his perspective on that.
Yeah, Brandon.
Yeah, a slight change in any year is how delegates to the national convention, national party conventions are chosen. In Indiana, the state Democratic Party, the convention votes on a lot of those delegates. Not all of them. There are a few that are kind of automatic, which is also the same for Republicans. But the convention at large generally votes for national, the state convention delegates vote for national convention delegates, which is something they had to do even this virtual year. Republicans do not have to do the same thing. That's chosen at more of a district level, and then a few are chosen at the state central, state party central committee level. But those don't generally happen at the convention itself. So that was a thing that Democrats had to worry about timing too, with delaying their convention and how is that going to work with the pandemic, because they had to certify their national convention delegates a certain amount of time before the national convention is set to happen. So there was some talk about how that would, and also with the primary, how that would be affected. So that's how that happens. But that's the biggest sort of substantive difference. Laura's right. There are some minor little technical issues in how they do some things. But functionally speaking, a lot of the same sort of things go on.
So the Democrats convened last weekend, and Republicans are having their convention on Thursday of this week. So besides the obvious change with the pandemic, I mean, people aren't in a room together. They're not having these conversations face to face. I guess, what effect do you think it's going to have that the Republican convention is virtual? I mean, I guess, could there be consequences or maybe even benefits that might not be obvious?
This is the big unanswered question. I feel like one thing I will mention, and I stand to be proven wrong on this, but at the state Democratic Party convention, they still voted for a party platform, which is a statement of beliefs that the convention delegates vote on. You know, we believe in X, Y, and Z. And there are sometimes fights over that, about certain what they call planks in the party platform. One coalition wants certain language added or subtracted, and another doesn't, and they have to hash that out before they get to the convention floor, or even sometimes on the convention floor itself. We certainly didn't see anything like that this year from the Democrats, in part because there was not a lot of chance to do something like that. But unless they haven't told us about it yet, what we've been told about what to expect from the Republican Party broadcast last night, which is their virtual convention, is speeches from the governor, the lieutenant governor, the four attorney general candidates. They have made no mention of adopting a party platform. Now, we're hearing a debate go on at the national level about the same thing, about in order to reduce the size of these conventions, which you want to do in a pandemic, they're getting rid of their platform committee and just readopting the 2016 platform at the national level. That creates its own problems because of what that platform says when it refers to the current administration. Here in Indiana, it doesn't really do the same thing. They don't refer to the current administration, in part because they've been in power for so long at the Republican level. But I haven't seen anything about them adopting a party platform. It's possible they might, but I haven't seen anything about that. So that would be one major change between what the Democrats and Republicans did this year. As for how the convention itself being virtual will affect, for instance, the races, that's really hard to say. I think the broader question is how the lack of direct voter contact, and in this case, delegate contact opportunities, were. Now, we've seen pictures from some of these candidates. They're going out and meeting delegates in person not wearing masks and not socially distancing, I might add, in a lot of these photos, regardless of the pandemic or not. So it's certainly still happening the way it would in a normal year. But there is something that happens on the floor of these conventions occasionally. In a circumstance where you have multiple candidates running for an office, like they do, particularly this year at the Republican Attorney General nomination, there are deals that happen on the floor of the convention that will obviously not be happening in any way, shape, or form this year. So that would be the biggest shift. And who that benefits, I cannot say. All I will say is one of the attorney general candidates, former Secretary of State and Congressman Todd Rokita, has actual experience in winning a contentious convention for fight. And so in theory, it might even hurt him that it isn't happening in person this year, because you lose some of that earned experience and knowledge. But that would be the only real, like, substantive change that I could identify for you right this second as a guaranteed difference.
Laura, any follow-up, knowing what you know about how conventions usually run versus the very different way they're going to run this year?
Yeah, well, as Brandon said, like, as a social scientist, this would be such a cool experiment to see. And of course, you can't make it perfect, so it's not. But to say, if we had it as we traditionally do, if we had the convention where there is that politicking, that, and we know the candidates are still going out and meeting delegates, but it's a whole lot harder when you have to drive from neighborhood to neighborhood versus knocking on hotel doors and just, you know, walking across the hallway, things like that. How that outcome looks different with that kind of politicking as we traditionally have in the political conventions versus what we have now where it's virtual. And I have no doubt that people, as we said, we've seen them meeting and are texting or calling, whatever it is, the politicking's different. I would love to have an experiment we could see, because the biggest question would be, what kind of outcome does this influence? Is it a different outcome? Does it change at least the process, but is the outcome the same? And that part's impossible to say, especially at this moment. I think longer term, maybe I say longer term, post general election, we could kind of look at it and say, maybe it had some kind of impact. It might be impossible. But I think the impact of the politicking and the way that it has to be done so differently right now from a virtual perspective is really unique. Maybe the only thing that makes it a little less exciting is if, and I don't say this with a light heart, but if we just had everything shut down and so all of a sudden it was like, oh my goodness, it's a panic. We've had a couple weeks of this in months, so people are used to Zoom etiquette and understanding how some of these processes work. It could get real crazy if it wasn't like that. But yeah, I think the politicking is the biggest thing.
Laura, we got an audience question about the Electoral College. Does the Electoral College relate in some way to party conventions?
Not in the way I'm guessing they're asking. I think a lot of times people think the Electoral College is selected at the convention or there's some sort of relationship there. So the Electoral College are the people that obviously elect the president. They're not related in terms of delegates necessarily. I suppose they potentially could be a delegate, but they most likely wouldn't be. Those are two separate American systems. And so when we think of the conventions, I like to think of them as organized and operated by the political parties. When you think of the Electoral College, that's an institution from the U.S. Constitution that determines the presidency and the leader of the executive branch. So organizationally, operationally, they're pretty different.
Brandon, do the Black and Latino caucuses have a place at these conventions?
They do in terms of what I talked about earlier with those sort of private meetings that happen before the public part of the convention. And we're talking about state conventions now. I will confess that I'm not an expert on the national conventions, and some of my answers may not apply to the national conventions. I will talk only about what I sort of cross my fingers know about, which is the state level.
Let's keep it local. Yeah.
Yeah. I've only been to like six of them now in Indiana. I suppose I should know a little bit about some of them. So yes, they have a role to play in those sort of private meetings and even putting up their own delegates. I don't believe, and I reached out to both parties to ask some questions about how delegates are chosen to make sure that I knew what I was talking about. But they didn't mention that, for instance, there are a certain amount of delegates allocated to Black and Latino caucuses. So that doesn't play a role in that way, as far as I'm aware. But of course, the Black and Latino caucuses, particularly in the Democratic Party, I confess I don't know if there is a Republican Black and Latino caucus, Black and or Latino caucus. But they certainly play an influential role in the Indiana Democratic Party. And so in that way, they are active in the convention the way other groups are. But as far as I'm aware, they don't have any sort of official role in having a certain number of delegates or anything like that.
Laura, I guess, and correct me if I'm wrong with this assumption, other than the obvious role that they play in the November election, you know, sort of helping to determine candidates, how much of an influence could these conventions have on the election in November?
Usually probably not a lot, if we're being really honest. And it goes back to a point that you made earlier. How many average people, right, whatever that means, how many regular voters are paying attention? And we're talking about regular average in this case, not being really partisan, not being tied to the political party directly or a candidate or a campaign, anything like that. And most of them are not paying attention to the state political conventions, maybe to the national ones later, certainly to debates that are coming up in September, October, but to the state conventions, I think most voters generally, and this is just going to be my assumption here, but probably don't pay attention to the presidential election until September, till maybe right around the state conventions or the national conventions. They probably don't have this on their horizon. So in terms of the impact, if we said, you know, what do we expect the convention to have on the election? It's to motivate the delegates. It's to get people excited about the platform. As Brandon said, sometimes to correct some of the planks, to make some adjustments there, to get introduced to the candidates and get excited about them. But it you're already speaking to your base. Like, it's the pep rally to your team and the people that already love you. You're not trying to convince everybody else, hey, you should vote for us. Everybody else isn't paying attention yet. They're not going to tune in until a couple months from now.
Brandon, how about a follow-up? Kind of the same question. How much influence, I guess, do these tend to have on elections and on the political landscape here?
Yeah, well, Laura's exactly right in that this is very, very, you're talking to people who are already paying attention. So you're not, but I will say the one thing, and again, this might be something to what Laura talked about earlier. We may never know the answer to this. We might be able to speculate about it later on, but given that we are broadcasting at least a portion of these conventions on television across the state this year in a way that we never do before. Now, there are stories written about them. So you will see little news clips occasionally every 2 years from these conventions. I write stories about them, that sort of thing. But actual broadcasts where you hear unfiltered the speeches that these candidates and these political officials are giving on television for everybody who wants to watch it, is something that's very different. And so I'm not sure we'll be able to see any measurable impact from that. I'm not sure how you would even measure that. But it is a thought that more than a typical year, they're certainly reaching more people than they normally do. I don't know that it'll have much impact, especially as Laura points out, we are in June. In a normal year, most people aren't thinking about the election. In this year of all years, I bet they probably aren't thinking about the election. They're thinking about a lot of other things in their lives right now. But on the off chance that someone was flipping around the channels and landed on Wish TV in Indianapolis and their affiliates elsewhere across the state and happened upon the state convention broadcast from one of these two parties and listened in, that might be a Hoosier or a voter that you don't normally target with these things, and they got to hear a little more than they normally do. Or you could, just as you normally do, tune into your local public broadcasting station and hear my story about it.
There we go. Okay, so with respect, I guess, to the Democratic convention, did it almost seem like, because of the different circumstances this year, did it almost seem like they were, and maybe this doesn't apply to everybody, but compensating for the different circumstances? Was there anyone who seemed like they were a little too excited because, you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I do. I will say no, in part because we didn't see a lot of people speak. So for instance, let's separate out the two things.
Yeah.
There was the broadcast, the TV broadcast, and the virtual convention that happened Thursday and then Saturday. At the broadcast, you know, it was all scripted in the sense that the speeches, of course, were scripted. Two of them were taped prior. The two AG candidates pre-taped their messages. The gubernatorial candidate and then the lieutenant governor candidate, Linda Lawson, gave their speeches live in studio. But they were scripted. They didn't, and because you don't have a crowd there, it's hard to, like, if someone had been, like, overexcited, it would have come off super duper weird. And then at the virtual convention, a lot of the messages that we saw from Gretchen Whitmer and from Joe Biden and all of the other folks that I've talked about, they were almost all, if not all, pre-taped as well. So they weren't happening live. And so in that sense, it's always going to feel a little different than a live speech in front of an audience. So yeah, it was probably a little more muted. It felt more like a Zoom meeting in the case of the virtual convention, which is pretty much exactly what it was, than it did a convention in that sense. It felt like a conference call a little more than a normal year. But for the most part, no, I didn't see a big difference or anybody trying to compensate for the difference in the style of convention.
Did it seem sterile, though, or was it still spirited enough to rally people?
Sterile is a good word for it.
There we go. Okay.
And there's nothing you can do about that.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take away an audience, I mean, for instance, today, the Premier League in England started playing again, obviously with no spectators, and they don't have crowd noise. Now, the broadcast on NBC piped in artificial crowd noise. It was weird because it didn't quite sync up with what was happening on the pitch. Obviously, the Democrats and the Republicans aren't doing anything like that. And so it's always going to feel a little more stilted, and sterile is a good word for it. But that's the reality. Like, I think there's an expectation of that. Like, nobody's expecting it to feel like a normal convention because it isn't. And everybody knows that.
We'll be back after a quick break with our conversation on political conventions in Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our conversation on political conventions in Indiana, taken from a Facebook Live event I hosted last night through a collaboration with our colleagues here at Indiana Public Broadcasting. So, Laura, we got an audience question that said, how can we weaken the divisive influence these primaries and conventions create in our elections? That's the whole question. What are some of these arguments you hear about conventions having this divisive impact?
Yeah, well, you go back to the party prep rally, right? They're trying to rally people on their side. I think this question is getting at that assumption, and a lot of people believe in this, of polarization in our country, that we seem to be getting more left on the left and more right on the right. And when you look at that 7-point Likert scale, people are moving to the extremes in the primaries, and they're kind of lobbied in this in convention too. Is if you're playing to your audience of hyper partisans, you don't want to come off as that middle four, you know, that bell curve. Like, you want, that's who you need to be as a candidate for the general, sure, but you're not going to win any favors in the audience of people who are at the state party conventions. So the question was, how do we prevent this? How do we dampen it? I think that's hard because that kind of goes against what the parties stand for in a lot of ways. But I would reframe it. I don't think we need to dampen it necessarily or to change it. I think the bigger question is, once the parties have selected their candidates, and that's through the primary, in which you have the primary voters selecting their candidates, they're probably going to be a little bit more extreme. They have to pivot to the general, right? Once we get into the general election season and, hey, we're here, this is when we ask the candidates where they stand on issues. This is where we really probe the candidates. Are they as extreme as they look? You know, or do they fit that more moderate, that average bell curve, four in a Likert scale of 7 points, a kind of voter? I think that's on us as voters and as citizens, as people paying attention to politics, to kind of challenge the candidates and probe at what they're doing. But I think political parties as an organization, they serve to kind of bring together people underneath a certain policy. They serve to provide that cheap, easy, but effective label of saying, you're a Democrat, you're a Republican, you stand for these things. I don't really fault the political parties as much in this system. I think it's on us as voters to challenge the candidates. And as soon as they've come out of that primary, where do they stand on the issues and who's the best fit for us?
Would you say Brandon, did you have a follow-up?
Well, I wanted to add that it's not, Laura kind of got to this, which was, it's not political party conventions that are to blame for the polarization of politics. Mm. Conventions have always existed, and things weren't always quite this polarized. If you want to dampen the polarization, which I think my guess would be that the person who asked the question is kind of driving towards. That gets to what Laura talked about, which is about us as voters, but also like making our election system more fair so that the person that, so, because you see it, for instance, we've seen it at the State House, where if you want to blame redistricting, as a lot of people do, but you look at where primaries have become a lot more important in a lot of seats than the general election has, that there are fewer and fewer competitive State House seats. Well, it's a similar kind of process here. Primary voters are more polarized. So you're not going to win an election as a Republican by going towards the center. You're going to win by going further to the right. As a Democrat, you're not going to win by going to the center. You're going to win by going further to the left. And so the folks who ultimately end up at the State House are the folks who have been pushed further to the right and further to the left. So fixing something like that gets you candidates, as she talked about, that are a lot closer to the middle of that bell curve than candidates who are further out on the edges. And if we were in a state that was more competitive statewide, for instance, and not in the state that was so thoroughly dominated by Republicans for the last decade, you would have candidates who needed to tack a little more towards the middle. You know, in the back of your mind, both as a candidate and as a delegate, that in order to win in November, you'd have to tack more towards, you need to find that more moderate candidate. That's not true necessarily in Indiana for Republicans. It has been what Democrats have been doing. For example, Jonathan Weinzapfel is by far the more moderate candidate of the two attorney general candidates. And in a very narrow vote, I should say, it was 1,057 for Weinzapfel, 1,009 for State Senator Karen Talion. Karen Talion is as liberal as it gets in Indiana. And enough delegates decided to go with the moderate choice because in their heads, well, that's the person who has the chance to win in November. So it's something that delegates definitely think about when they're casting their ballot.
We got another question, Laura, from our audience, and this one says, how are private organizations like the GOP and DNC allowed to use taxpayer money to pay for their parties? I guess, can you explain the context for this? How are these paid for?
Yeah, so they're sponsored by the party themselves, but they are for a statewide election. And I know the details of it are very complicated and quite frankly beyond my understanding, too. I should make that disclaimer. But these are to promote their state-recognized political parties and the candidates that are running for the general election coming up. I think I'd probably pass that over to Brandon, too. He might know more of the specifics there beyond what I do.
Right. So if the question was about the DNC and the RNC, which is the national conventions, I will confess to not knowing how those are funded. At the state level, they simply aren't taxpayer funded. These are private organizations. They raise private dollars, sure from taxpayers, but from anybody who's willing to give to them. Taxpayer dollars, there is not a dime in the state budget that I read every 2 years that goes to putting on the state party conventions.
Brandon, we've talked on the show a number of times about the misconduct allegations made toward State Attorney General Curtis Hill.
And that sounds familiar.
Indeed. Yeah, we've had a few conversations about it. And of course, the long process to find out what consequences might come of them. Can you catch us up on where that situation is at right now and how the convention relates to it?
Sure. Well, today happens to be a good day to ask that question because Curtis Hill got to go back to work today for the first time in 30 days. And the reason he couldn't be at work for the last 30 days before now was because the Indiana Supreme Court, after a months-long state attorney disciplinary commission investigation and hearing, the Indiana Supreme Court, about a month or a little over a month ago, said that Curtis Hill, they found that Curtis Hill had criminally battered four women, which is what had been alleged 2 years ago when it happened, and that for that criminal battery, his law license was suspended for 30 days and then automatically reinstated. So he had to stop being attorney general for 30 days. Now, there were a lot of questions, and there still are, about whether that should have meant that he had vacated the office, allowing the governor to appoint a replacement. And the governor, in this case, Eric Holcomb, definitely would not have appointed someone that Curtis Hill wanted, because the two of them, to put it mildly, do not get along. And that was true, by the way, before the allegations about Curtis Hill came out. But That question is outstanding. It was something that the Supreme Court did not address, and it still has not addressed. There are a couple lawsuits that tried to say, hey, Curtis Hill doesn't have a law license, or his law license is suspended. He needs to be out. And they didn't get far enough for the Supreme Court to weigh in on them during the suspension. Those lawsuits can still technically move forward, theoretically, on the question of law. And it's possible that the Supreme Court might weigh in at some point if this were to ever happen in the future, so that at least we'd know. But certainly, as it relates to Curtis Hill, he was the attorney general. For 30 days, he had to stop being attorney general, and he is once again attorney general. As it relates to the convention, he got back to work today, and tomorrow he will give a speech, although they may have pre-taped it, so maybe he's already taped it. But tomorrow they will televise a speech by Curtis Hill in which he will ask Republican delegates to renominate him for attorney general. There is nothing in state law or anywhere else that says he cannot be renominated or even reelected attorney general.
I hate to ask you to prognosticate, but do you have any idea as to how that will turn out? I mean, does it look like it'll be Curtis Hill? Will it be Todd Rokita?
Yeah, you say you hate to ask me to prognosticate.
But I'm gonna.
I don't think you hate it. So before, you just mentioned Todd Rokita, and I've mentioned him once before, former Secretary of State, former Congressman. Before Todd Rokita got into the race, I was maybe not confident, but I was predicting Curtis Hill would be renominated and personally predicting that he would be reelected in the fall. Todd Rokita's entrance into the race dramatically changes that for me, enough to the point where I don't actually want to make a prediction.
Sure, fair enough.
Not to refuse outright, but I'm going to refuse outright. I hate to refuse to answer your question, but I'm going to do it anyway. I really have no idea what Todd Rokita's entrance into the race does to that race. I think there's still a good chance that Curtis Hill gets renominated. I'm not going to rule it out, certainly. But I feel fairly confident saying it's almost certainly going to either be Curtis Hill or Todd Rokita. It feels very unlikely that the other candidates, who I should say are Decatur County Prosecutor Nate Harder and an Indianapolis attorney, area attorney named John Westerkamp, it seems very unlikely to me that one of those two will be the nominee. But I really don't know who it's going to be of Rokita and Hill. And we should explain a little bit real quick here about how the voting process works both this year and in most years. So at a normal convention, let's say this year, actually, you can go back 4 years when there were four or five candidates for attorney general on the Republican side at the convention. So let's say these four candidates, Hill, Rokita, Harder, Westerkamp, were running in a normal year where everybody was in an in-person convention. The way the voting works is you do round one, all of the delegates vote. Unless one of the candidates gets 50% plus one of that ballot, you go to a second round. The person with the lowest amount of votes drops out. They can no longer be a candidate. So just going in alphabetical order, let's say it's John Westerkamp. Westerkamp's no longer on the ballot. So now it's between Hill, Harder, and Rokita. Another round of voting. If somebody gets 50% plus one of the total votes cast, they're the candidate. If not, you once again drop off the lowest vote getter. And now you go to what would be in a four-person race, the final ballot between two candidates. And when I talked earlier about an adjustment to conventions this year being that on-the-floor politicking, when you are the candidate who gets dropped off a ballot, well, now you have people who voted for you who could, they don't have to vote again, but likely they will, vote for somebody else. Who is that going to be? You will have candidates throw their support behind someone else. So you had, I think, don't hold me to this because I don't want him to get mad at me, but you had a state senator who was running for attorney general 4 years ago who didn't advance to the next ballot and threw his support behind Curtis Hill. And so that's a case that happened. That happened on the floor. And so that was, you know, he was telling the people who voted for him, hey, go vote for this guy instead. This year, because it's just mail-in ballots and one round of it, they are doing ranked choice voting. So on the ballot, you will have four names and you can say, I want, you know, Curtis Hill, number one, Todd Rokita, number two, Nate Harden, number three, John Westerkamp, number four, or any variation thereof. If you want, You don't have to rank your choices. If you are a diehard John Westerkamp voter, he's the only name you have to put on there. They will use that ranked choice system to do, to kind of try to replicate what the in-person multiple round balloting system looks like. So that's also a to explain how they do that. That's how they're doing it.
And just to add to that, if you say you're the diehard voter and that person drops out and you don't have another vote, you're done. there's no opportunity. As you said, this is where you miss that politicking on the floor, behind the scenes, whatever it might be. You're out. And you made that decision when you marked your ballot that one way and you had your other options for different rounds and you chose not to mark them. I think that part's kind of neat too.
One thing I'll add real quick is Laura's absolutely right in that you have Curtis Hill and Todd Rokita, who both have strong name recognition in the party. And that's both for better and for worse, because both of them have made enemies over the years. Todd Rokita, I love the story. I love telling the story. Todd Rokita was Secretary of State for 2 terms at the State House and did not make a lot of friends in the General Assembly. When the Republicans in the Indiana House were redrawing districts in 2010, after he'd just been elected to Congress in the 4th District, they drew him out of his congressional seat.
Oof.
They didn't have to. They chose to. Now, that didn't ultimately matter because in Congress, you don't have to live in your district, unlike at the State House. You just have to live in the state. So it didn't have any tangible impact on him. And certainly he was reelected 3 more times. But that was because it was out of spite. Let's be honest. It was out of spite. And that's the sort of relationships we're talking about here. So, yes, Todd Rokita has lots of friends in the Indiana Republican Party, but he has more than a few enemies, too. And Curtis Hill is the same way. So you have the push and pull. There is no huge likable candidate, you know, or universally likable candidate, I should say, in this race, which makes it even more interesting to see what the result will be.
And yet another reason not to prognosticate, of course. So, Laura, a lot of people in the last few months have commented about how weird it is, considering we're in a presidential election year, that interest in politics has gone down. How much of an effect do you think that the pandemic and also the protests on police violence and other big news stories are having on the general amount of attention being given to these conventions?
Yeah, well, it's undeniable. And I'd say most people don't pay attention to the conventions anyway. So even though we talked about there's more accessibility, I don't think that people are like overwhelmingly now interested in the conventions. Just the political process itself, usually that's really a big talking point at this time of year, even here in June, because we'd be a month away from our primary. We just got out of that. You know, we'd be looking ahead. Understandably, people are sidetracked. They're busy with other things in terms of COVID-19, in terms of the economy, in terms of the protest. Now, the irony that as someone who admittedly loves politics can't get over, these are all political issues. So you really should be paying attention. You really should care, though they are not necessarily political issues that are going to be discussed or determined or talked about the state party conventions. They are things that candidates will be looking at and certainly policies will be affecting. But it is the most unusual, and I know that's a horribly cliched phrase that we're overusing, but I'm comfortable overusing it in this case, the most unusual of presidential election cycles. Had you asked me at any point pre, let's say, early March 2020, you know, like how exciting and how much attention, how much focus there'd be on this election cycle at this point, I would have guessed something entirely different than what we currently see, of course.
Well, this has been a great discussion. I want to thank our guests tonight. Laura Wilson is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Indianapolis. We really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thanks as always.
Absolutely. This was a lot of fun.
And to everyone listening, please stay in touch. You can share your questions and let us know what topics are important to you by texting the word elections to 73224 to join the Indiana 2022 way. And you'll hear from our colleagues at Indiana Public Broadcasting every Thursday as they share reporting that was created from your responses. Again, to join, text elections to 73224. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Join us tomorrow for the Friday Pitch-In, where we recap some of the biggest headlines of the week. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.